You're listening to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience, with your hosts Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Good morning and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back. And good evening and welcome once again to Spirit Radio, The Paranormal Experience. I am your host, Willie Hassel, your gatekeeper to the dark side, your guide to the realm of the unknown, the unseen, the unthinkable. And she is the always lovely, she is the mystical, she is the mysterious, and she is Lynn Nickerson. How are you?
Hello, Willie. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Kind of took you by surprise there, didn't I?
I know, I'm glad I had my candy fix. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to handle it. All of a sudden, all this energy, I had this energy surge, and
I know it.
Bam.
All of a sudden, you realize, we're on the air.
I went right into gear, high gear.
I saw you running around in circles over there.
You saw I had no headphone, no headset.
Yeah. So outside of that, how's everything?
Very well, thank you. You know, the weather has just a little bit of a crisp feel to it. It's turning a little fallish.
Yeah, a little bit.
As much as I love summer.
Yeah, I know.
I hate to see it go, but the fall's great, too.
It is. It's actually kind of muggy out tonight. But
it is a little humid.
Some leaves starting to blow around and stuff.
I know.
It kind of puts you in the mood for...
For fall.
Hey, fall.
Yes, for fall.
I was going to say things like ghosts and...
True.
Paranormal stuff.
They go hand in hand.
Yeah, you know, all that kind of stuff. Halloween is coming. Absolutely.
The only problem with that, though, there's always a downside to the good stuff.
I know.
This fall is followed by the four-letter word.
It
starts with an S. I'm not going to break.
Starts with a W, I think.
S or W.
Snow, okay.
You said it!
I thought you meant winter.
For sure. Now we're going to be haunted by an early snowfall.
You can blame Willie. As long as we're haunted. That's all that really matters.
Okay.
In my book.
From a true ghost hunter.
That's right. That's what it's all about. It's all about being haunted.
Well, in the spirit of the fall, we decided we would do some ghost stories tonight. And
is that what we're going to do?
And another few paranormal things that remain unexplained.
I believe you called it a paranormal
potpourri.
Potpourri.
No, it's potpourri, Willie. that means a mixture.
It can be potpourri if I want it to be.
But it'll give us a bad impression.
Okay. No, we don't want that. Okay. Potpourri it is.
That's right. We're good with our French.
Oh, is that French?
It is French.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You underestimate me.
I just thought it was an odd word. I didn't know it was French.
No. Are you implying I'm odd?
No.
Okay, that was the right answer.
No. I know it was the right answer. I didn't even have to think about it. There was two ways I could go on that. One would be okay, the other one, not so much.
So, who's going to start out? Shall I start out with my bizarre train story?
Why don't you do that? Your bizarre train story, because I know this is a true story. It's your own.
It is. I thought we could start out with that. And it still remains open-ended. I haven't got an answer yet. I've been doing a little research on this. So this is my train story. It started on September 14th. That's 2 days before the full moon. So sometimes I sleep, and I'll sleep for 2 hours, and then I'll get up and read. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was wide awake, and I was reading. At exactly 3 o'clock, I hear a train whistle. Now, I live in Kittery, and there used to be a track that was used all the time to come into Kittery. I know that the Navy Yard uses it sometime, but I'll get into that in a second. So at 3 o'clock, I hear several pulls on the whistle, and then the train is very loud, and I can hear it rumbling. The whistle blows again at 3:06. It blows again at 3:20, and it blows a fourth time at 3:25. Each time I get up, I go to the window, I stick my ear to the open window, listening for this train going, and it's traveling very quickly. It's probably doing about 40 miles an hour, 45. It's pretty fast. And I'm thinking, for as long as I've lived in Kittery, I've never heard a train rumbling through the town. And there is the one set of tracks that, as I said, feeds the Navy Yard. And what they do is they dispose of expended rods, nuclear rods
from the submarines,
And they send them out of town. So there is one set of tracks, and yet that goes under the Mildred Long Bridge. And right now it's fenced off, and I went down and inspected it today, and there's a truck on the tracks as well. So this happened only 3 nights ago. So number one, it was a fast-moving train. Number two, why did it blow its whistle 4 separate times within 25 minutes? I never really heard it stop, but I didn't stay at the window that entire time. So I asked a few people, and I was told that the Navy Yard still does use the track, but I can't help but think that maybe there's sort of like an abeyance or something until they can use the Sarah Mildred Long Bridge for that, because I think that it's temporarily closed off. So I did some research, and in 1939, there was a train crash on the Piscataqua Bridge, which was there before the Sarah Mildred Long. That was 1939. It was built apparently in 1840, I believe. So in 1939, there was the crash. The engine fell into the Piscataqua, and then the next car, which is called the tender car, and then the first passenger car fell into the river. And that was empty, but two people did lose their lives. All of the passengers, their lives were saved. So it's well known that two of the cars, maybe three, I'm not certain on that, but the engine and the tender car are still in the Piscataqua. The date of that crash was September 10, and there seemed to be no other crashes at that time. I looked at a list of crashes in New Hampshire and Maine. So it was 4 days off. So I don't know if there's a connection, but, you know, if anybody lives around the Piscataqua River, like maybe Mr. Edwin Rockford, is that his name?
It could be.
Yes,
could be.
He probably could.
I think
could.
He lives pretty close.
Pretty close to that area. So yeah. If a train were rumbling through, he might have heard it. So perhaps he might be able to solve the mystery. But I've spoken to other people in town, and no one seems to know what that was. Oh, as an addendum, let me mention, I spoke to somebody who lives in town, and he did say someone had acquired a train whistle that he put on his boat. And that may be true, but what would account for the noise of the train, unless someone's got a special effects tape? Because I heard a train rumbling very quickly. And the other point is, who would be up at 3 o'clock in the morning blowing the train whistle?
Well, now that somebody could be, but what strikes
true,
me as strange about it, I mean, it does make sense that the train would be going in and out of the Navy Yard.
But, yeah.
But the part that doesn't make sense to me is in 9 years, is it? You've never heard it before.
Well, 9 years this time and 6 years a while ago I lived in Kittery and never heard a train.
And why would you suddenly hear it this time?
I don't know. So, I just think it's so odd.
So maybe it is a ghost train.
It might be.
I mean, there are such things.
There are. So if anybody has any information that might like to call in or email us, we'd certainly welcome any kind of response to that. So thank you in advance.
Speaking of calling in, we have no guest on the line tonight, so that means that we do have an open phone line. If anybody just wants to give us a call and, hey, tell us a ghost story. That'd be neat, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that somebody, would be very
somebody
nice.
Somebody wants to call and tell us a ghost story or, yep. You know, any kind of strange, unusual, supernatural, anything bizarre.
Weird, creepy.
Yeah.
This is the season for it.
We're open to all that. And if you were to happen to want to call, they would probably want to know what number
they would,
to call.
I think they want the number, Willie.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's give this one a try. 603-430-9722. Does that sound right?
That sounds right on.
I think that's it. So, you know, give us a call. Tell us a story. Ask us a question. Whatever you want to do. We're here.
So I believe it's your turn.
It's my turn?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, well.
Tell us a creepy story.
Well, I don't know if it's a creepy story, but I want to tell you about the York Witch.
Oh, York,
right,
Maine?
Right, yeah, right across the little bridge there,
okay.
Over in York, Maine, in the little village of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
Right on the coast.
So was she a good witch or a bad witch? Do you have any idea?
You know, I'm just going to have to let you figure that one
out. Oh, you're going to leave it up to the audience?
Well, yeah, there was kind of a question about it, whether she is a good witch or a bad witch, or whether she was a witch.
Okay.
But in the little village of York, Maine, the ghost of a witch haunts the local cemetery. If she actually was a witch or not, or just a well-meaning old lady, only to try and help other neighbors. Nobody really knows for sure. But in the town of York, which was incorporated in 1652 and sits on an even older Indian community of Agamenticus.
Oh, Agamenticus, yeah.
Agamenticus,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently there was an Indian community before they came in and built York.
Well, that surprises me, but I wasn't surprised that it was on that same ground. Mm.
The old York Cemetery, which is older than the neighboring church, which dates back to 1747, with the oldest gravestones decorated with death heads and wings, which look much like flying skulls.
Mm.
Apparently meant to symbolize the death of the body, but the immortality of the soul. So anyway, as with most cemeteries, most of the graves in the cemetery are marked with a single headstone. Or some, actually, you know, they have the footstone also to mark the other end of the boundary of the grave. But the witch's grave has a little something extra.
What?
Not only a headstone and a footstone, but also a huge boulder across the midsection, which is kind of weird.
What's the boulder? I thought it had a huge slab. A stone slab.
A slab is only a flat boulder.
Oh, okay, Willie. Okay.
Okay. a boulder is a fat slab. You know, whichever way you want to look at it. I'm not going to argue about it.
It depends on perspective.
That's right. Oh, it's going to be one of those kind of nights. All right. Okay. A huge boulder across the midsection. She was hanged for witchcraft in 1744. Her name was Mary Miller Jason, and she haunts the cemetery to this day. Now, why is the huge boulder over her grave, and why was it placed there? Any idea?
I think I do know. They don't want her to get out.
That's right.
Yeah.
It was to prevent her from rising from the grave. Yet still, her apparition is seen walking around the cemetery with a hangman's noose still around her neck.
Oh, you're kidding.
I wouldn't kid about stuff like that.
Mm, okay. That's pretty serious.
Well, if it's serious, why are you laughing?
There's a conundrum.
Okay. At the time of Mary's trial, many of the townspeople believed that she actually wasn't a witch. She was innocent because it seems that Mary had learned much about the use of natural herbal medicines from the local Indians. And all she wanted to really do was help her neighbors. So was she a witch or a pioneer in natural healing? However, the problem was the burden of proof of innocence was on her. And it's impossible. How can you prove that you're not a witch? So the sentence was carried out, and Mary Miller Jason was hung for the crime of witchcraft. And there is also the tradition that a flock of crows will frequent the graves of witches, said to be familiars, supernatural animals controlled by the witches to do their bidding and help protect them. So if you happen to go by the Old York Cemetery and see a flock of crows gathering around a certain gravesite, you just may see the apparition of Mary Jason Miller wandering around with a noose firmly wrapped around her neck.
I hadn't heard that story, but that is really pretty interesting.
I thought it was.
What was the source of that?
That was for my book, titled something.
Okay.
And if you really want to know, I'll turn it around and find you.
But I wanted to comment and answer one of your questions. Okay. The way they used to find out if somebody was a witch is if they drowned, they were innocent, but if they bobbed back up again, they were a witch. So you have to die to prove yourself that you were a witch. That's number one. And number two.
Well, that would be kind of like impossible to prove, then, wouldn't it?
You know, kind of is. Proof, but you don't get to live to enjoy it.
Oh, right, exactly.
The Indians were famous for using herbs and healing, and white people picked up on that, but it wasn't just something for white people. Back in England, back in Germany, there were many, many women who... They were original herbalists is what they were. I mean, they used natural cures and things for medicinal purposes.
Yeah, they were just way ahead of the... Today, you would go to a store and spend all kinds of money for that kind of stuff.
Yes,
and,
that's
right. She learned all this from the local Native Americans, and some people just thought that she was,
Well, some people just superstitious.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
They certainly were back then.
Yeah. And so they said, oh, well, she must be a witch.
And was there anything else that made people say that? I mean, did the milk go sour, or did their cows die, or their crops die?
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah. What is her name again, Mason?
Her name is, I will tell you in just a minute, Mary Miller Jason.
Mary Miller Jason. I've never heard of her, but I think Roxy might have written a story about her.
You know, that's entirely possible.
Yeah.
It is. And you haven't been up to the York Cemetery to look for her grave? Or?
No, I haven't. I've been up there, but I didn't know of her at the time to look for her grave.
Yeah. Did you see any flocks of crows?
No, but I saw a really big flat boulder. Do you suppose was her?
I think you would call that a slab.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that. But.
Well, my next story, that was very interesting, by the way.
Continue.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
This story comes from, as do the rest of these, I've got four more stories here. It's from the book titled Ghost Stories of New England, and it's written by Susan Smitten, S-M-I-T-T-E-N. I don't know much about Susan, but this really is an intriguing little book. This story is called The Jawless Ghost, and it happened in Bath, Maine. And it's a case of people coming back and looking completely solid, and they appear to other individuals because they want to finish up unfinished business. They want to set something straight or set something right. So they come back and they visit people, and this is exactly what happened. And this actually had been well documented. In fact, all four of these stories have been well documented. So it happened to be a man by the name of York with an E met a rather untimely and rather messy demise just a few days before Christmas in 1890. And he was attempting to cross the train tracks near the depot in Portland, Maine, actually, where he was struck and killed by the Portland Express. Because the train couldn't slow down in time, York's remains were found scattered along the tracks. Very sad. So authorities undertook the gruesome task of collecting York's bones to inter with the rest of his remains, and they managed to recover everything except a piece of the poor man's lower jawbone. So in the Bath Daily Times, which is the newspaper, they reported that the missing bone was in the possession of an entrepreneur by the name of George Carpenter. And for some reason, which... You should never disrespect the dead or disrespect their remains.
No.
For some reason, he had picked up the last piece of the jawbone, and he kept it as a memento.
Now, why would somebody want to do that?
Very strange thinking, isn't it?
Mm. I mean, take it home and put it on your mantle?
I don't know. Figure out the mind of someone who would do that. Mm. So he picked it up, and it would seem that Mr. Carpenter got more than he bargained for.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah, good. So apparently, he shared his secret with his best friend, who was a Mr. Bettenhausen, and he was a well-established cigar manufacturer. And Bettenhausen, with a very big heart, decided that he would offer to clean the fragment of bone for Mr. Carpenter. Sounds to me like he wanted to get it out of his possession. So anyway, Mr. Carpenter handed over the bone to Mr. Bettenhausen for cleaning. And this Mr. Bettenhausen was the only person who knew where the skeletal fragment had been stored. So 3 days after getting the bone, Bettenhausen got the surprise of his life. He had just closed up the store and was preparing to go home when he started to see a man sitting on a chair. I'm sorry, he was startled. To see a man sitting on a chair by the door, which he had just bolted, and he turned around and he saw the person sitting there. So he was solid as a regular person. The shopkeeper knew that there hadn't been anybody there just a couple of minutes ago, and he confronted the man and he says, "Who are you and what you're doing there?" And to Bettenhausen's astonishment, the man answered that he was there to get the jawbone. "I've come for the piece of my jaw that you have in that box on the shelf," the man said.
"The piece of my jaw, huh?"
"Yes, okay. My jaw." So as Bettenhausen stammered that the bone belonged to Mr. George Carpenter, he wasn't going to give it to this guy. But the man insisted that he take the bone because he wanted the bone to be buried with the rest of his body.
Okay, well, I can understand that.
Yeah. But it does make you wonder who this guy is sitting there at the door.
Yeah.
So the stubbornness was too much for the businessman to bear. Certainly a practical joke was being played on him, at least that's what he thought. So he turned to fetch his loaded revolver. His loaded revolver that he kept on a nearby shelf. When he turned around again, the man had vanished. That scared Mr. Bettenhausen. He grabbed his coat and he rushed out the door. The next day, in broad daylight, he returned the box with the bone to Mr. Carpenter. And he said he never wanted to set eyes on the thing again. I guess the bone didn't get cleaned. But somehow, the story of Bettenhausen's inexplicable encounter with Mr. York's spirit circulated throughout the town of Bath. When the authorities heard about it, they promptly confiscated the jawbone from Carpenter and buried it along with the rest of the original owner's remains. So apparently, Mr. York's spirit is resting in peace because no one has heard from him again. But this was, you know, well documented, and you just don't do things like that to dead people. They'll come back at you.
That's right. I think the moral of this story is,
yes, Willie.
leave jawbones where they lay.
Something to that effect. Well enough alone.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I'm not really quite sure how that goes.
Whoops, true story. I know there's a moral
to the story. So.
Well, that's it. You don't keep stuff that isn't yours.
Yeah, there you go.
And don't show disrespect to the dead.
Oh, absolutely. That bothers me. That's the big thing, yeah.
You
have to respect.
All of the black people being buried under the streets of Portsmouth, that's another thing. So at least we've kind of rectified that a little bit and reconciled with their anger.
Yeah, at least they have,
they've reconciled.
Reconciled. Yeah. It's not the word.
A little bit, but
not the word I was looking for, but it's going to have to do because I can't.
Yeah, but
think
it's
of
nice that they've established a memorial for having done that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm waiting with bated breath. Oh, do you have a question for me?
I do.
Okay.
I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. You are familiar with the subject of telephone calls from the dead, are you not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I haven't received one, but I've read several stories about it. It does happen.
A friend of ours, Kel Cooper, a parapsychologist, has written.
He did a lot of research on that.
Yeah, a couple of books: Telephone Calls from the Dead and Phone Calls from Beyond. Was it?
I don't remember. A lot of the work of Alex Tanis.
Yeah, Alex Tanis and. But anyway, he has done a lot of research on, you know, the strange phenomenon of people receiving phone calls from dead loved ones.
Yeah.
Phone calls that came after the person had died.
Yeah.
And it's very, very strange. Would you like to know about one of those?
Oh, I was hoping after that intro you'd certainly tell me one.
Well, no, I could just drop it there and we could say, hey, it's the bottom of the hour.
You know? Well, you could start it. We got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, we got a couple of minutes. Yeah, okay. Well, this is the story of Kel. Not Kel, Carl. Kel's the one that wrote the book.
Uh-huh.
So the story is Carl.
Carl.
And he was kind of having problems around home, you know, coping with friends and relationships and all that kind of stuff. So he just decided, well, I'm just going to go away for a little while. And so it was August 11th of 1969, and he headed for the coast. And I'm assuming it was the west coast.
Of England?
I think he was in the U.S.
Hmm.
You know, he just wanted to take a break from the whole situation. And he got out there, and he just stumbled across a perfect place, a cottage by the sea.
Hmm.
It was owned by an elderly lady, and she had a room to rent. And just call me Grandma, she would say. She was just a nice, friendly old lady. So anyway, she showed him to a room filled with antiques, which included, you know, those old wall-mounted 19th century telephones with the little crank on the side of them.
Oh, yeah, the wooden crank phones.
Yeah, you know, hello, Martha, could you connect me to, you know those things. So, you know, along with a lot of other antiques, he had one of those on the wall. So anyway, he moved into the room, and he carried on with his life. Didn't pay any attention to the phone on the wall until one night, after spending a day at the beach, he'd gone to bed. It was 11:13 p.m. and the phone rang. It woke him up, and you know, because he was afraid, well, my cover's blown now, you know, somebody knows where I am. So he didn't want to answer the phone, but finally he did. And as I said, this was 11:13 p.m. This was the old phone on the wall. The old antique phone.
Which probably wasn't even connected.
And he picked up the headset, and he heard his father's voice.
Oh.
Are you there, Carl? Your mother will be trying to reach you. Give her a call, and she will have a message for you. It's kind of weird. So Carl replied, well, put her on the phone now. I'll talk to her. And, you know, it's kind of strange. What's this all about? So his father said, I can't. She's not with me. Where are you calling from? Carl asked. It's a very beautiful place, his father replied. Be sure you call your mother, Carl. Goodbye. He just hung up.
Hmm.
So Carl thought, you know, I must be dreaming or something. So he put it out of his mind. He went to bed. Got up the next morning. He was having breakfast with Grandma. And so he told her about the story. And she said the phone on the wall, late husband had picked up at an antique store.
It didn't work.
It's not even connected. There's no wires connected to it or anything. And she said, well, you know, something sounds strange. You better call your mother. So, you know, see what's going on. So, you know, he did. She gave him, you know, gave him her real phone that actually works, her modern phone. He called his mother, and his mother immediately answered on the first ring and says, where have you been? She said, nobody knew where you were, and I've been frantic trying to call you all night. She says, Carl, your father died of a heart attack at 11:13 last night.
Mm.
So he immediately returned home, and the only person who had known his whereabouts was his father, who it turns out was dead when he made the phone call.
Wow.
And that's rather strange, isn't it?
Well documented.
Yeah, well documented, and he's like we said, he's done a lot of research on these phone calls.
That's something. What book was that one from? Telephone Calls from the Dead.
That was from Telephone Calls from the Dead. Yes,
by Kel Cooper.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you know what?
We are at the bottom of the hour, aren't we?
Yeah, we are just about at the bottom of the hour. So why don't we go ahead and take a break?
All right.
Yeah, you want to do that?
We'll be back in just a minute.
Or two.
Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. And you are listening to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Well, now, how about another story?
Hey, tell me another story.
Okay.
Is it a ghost story?
Well, it actually isn't, but it's very odd, and it's kind of like unbelievable.
Okay.
So it's kind of like on a border.
Test me, see if I believe it.
Well, it's not a ghost story, but it's kind of like borderline paranormal.
Okay.
Again, this is from Ghost Stories of New England by Susan Smitten. This chapter is entitled Owl's Head Light, and Owl's Head Light is in Rockland Harbor, Maine. So that's up the coast a little bit from Kittery. So there have been, you know, various tales of ghosts around Owl's Head Light, but there's one story in particular which is pretty interesting. There was a storm that hit the coastline on December 22nd, 1850. Now, this is what happened. There were three people on this small schooner. And, of course, being in December, it was very icy and it was very cold.
Schooner, that's a sailboat, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's got sails on it. It's got masts on it. Okay.
Just checking.
Mm-hmm. So the storm rose and the ship was being battered about. One man went overboard. There were three people on board. One man escaped and he escaped to some frozen rocks. And then the other two were left on the boat, hanging to the mast. So the guy that wound up on a frozen rock, he was seen by the lighthouse keeper. The lighthouse keeper happened to be riding along the coast in a sleigh. Excuse me. He saw the man. He rescued the man, brought him into his house. His name was, I want to say Ingraham. That was the other guy. Well, I'll get to that in a second. But the guy who was on the icy rock was brought to the lighthouse keeper's house. He was given some rum to warm him up, and they put him to bed. And
rum, that will do it.
Well, he was pretty frozen.
Well, yeah, I understand that.
Then he went on to talk about the two people that were still left on the boat that was being battered about out in the ocean. So they got out there. They went in a boat, got out to the boat. The two people that were left on the boat had been hanging onto the mast, and they were frozen in a block of ice. And the lighthouse keeper decided he wasn't going to leave anything to chance. He was going to try and save these people if he could. So with the other people that he was with, the crew cut them away from the mast. They loaded this block of ice of two people onto a boat, and they got them back to the lighthouse keeper's house. They put everything, that block of ice with the two people in it, they started chipping away, and they put them in cooler water, or I should say warmer water, and they slowly warmed up the block of ice, chipping away the whole time until they finally freed the two people. And then they got them to, they finally started breathing. And the name of these two people were Lydia Dyer and Richard Ingram, and they happened to be engaged. And they were the only three people on the boat. The other gentleman, I'm not finding his name here, I think it was Elliot. So anyway, the keeper chilled them from the chipped away at their icy tomb and slowly warmed up their bodies, and they actually opened their eyes and they were able to speak. And it took them a while. It was about 24 hours before they could eat, and it took them several months to recover, but they did recover, and they happened to get married, and they wound up having four children. So I thought that was an incredible story. Chipped away in a solid block of ice.
It is. It basically is being brought back from the dead.
They really were. You know? They were resuscitated.
I mean, technically, were they dead?
Who knows?
Because being frozen in ice like that, you know, they were kind of, what do they call it, suspended.
Like suspended animation,
yeah,
or like cryonics or something.
Yeah, that's the word, cryonics, yeah.
So how long were they in the ice? Maybe 2, 3, or 4 hours by the time they were discovered, brought back, thawed out, defrosted. So, you know, I would think that there might be some dead brain tissues. I mean, I kind of think they probably died.
And I'm betting they had a pretty good case of frostbite, too.
It doesn't mention that, but they probably did. Who knows? Maybe they were freeze-dried real quickly.
Yeah, but yeah, maybe.
I just thought that was an incredible story. So there is go ahead.
I was just going to say it's totally unrelated, but it kind of reminds me of that David Blaine stunt, frozen in the block of ice in New York City there.
I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. Well, never mind then.
You can tell me in a second. I'll just wrap this up. So there have been different apparitions on the island, but one of them is thought to be Lydia Dyer, only because she went through so much trauma after she was resuscitated from the dead. So they kind of think that it is she that is walking the island there at Owl's Head Light.
Owl's Head Light in
Rockland Harbor, Maine.
Rockland Harbor, yeah.
Yeah, Rockland Harbor, Maine. So that's the end of the story. So what did David Blaine, did you say?
Oh, it's totally unrelated. He's a magician, and he did this. Well, he does all these weird stunts. Mm. And one time,
isn't that David Copperfield? You mean David Blaine?
Blaine.
I haven't heard of him.
Yeah, one time a few years ago, he did this thing where he actually was encased in a block of ice on the sidewalk of New York City for something like 48 hours.
Really?
Yeah. He always did weird stuff like that.
And he lived to tell about it.
Yeah, he lived to tell about
it.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. I don't really know why I threw that in. It just
the block of ice
reminded me of it. That's all.
Mm-hmm. So is he a ghost now?
No, as far as I know, he's still alive. I haven't heard anything about him lately. But he is a magician, but he also kind of, you know, mind over matter type stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, he would do a lot of these
kind of like Harry Houdini almost.
A lot of he did escapes too, and a lot of things that you just can't imagine being physically capable of doing, like being frozen in a block of ice.
Mm. So, what's your next story?
I was just going to say, what do you want to do now?
I want to do your next story.
Okay. Well, it just happens that so do I. I was just going to talk about a couple of haunted bed and breakfast type inns. And I'm not going to mention the names of them, because after all, this isn't a commercial, you know.
Okay.
One of them was in Brewster, Mass., and it was in 1828, the inn was originally the First Universalist Church of Brewster. The church eventually moved to a larger building, and the structure was then converted into an inn. And over the years, the inn went by many names. And at one point, it played host a number of times to the maestro, Arthur Fiedler.
Remember Say that again?
Arthur Fiedler from
Arthur
the Boston
Fiedler,
Pops.
Yes, yeah.
Remember him? Yeah. Anyways, the inn fell into disrepair for many years until it was purchased and restored in 1995 with a bunch of bright, cheerful guest rooms. The owners, they had a dog, a Cocker Spaniel, and he would often bark at nothing, when he was accompanying the housekeeper, cleaning the rooms, as if he was just barking at some unseen presence in the air. And then one night, a couple was staying in room two. Remember that. That's very important, room two.
Okay, room two.
And Bob, who is the guest, but not his real name, because they just made it up, he went up to bed before his wife, and he fell asleep. She stayed downstairs for a little while, and then she came up a little bit later and joined him, climbed into bed beside him. And suddenly Bob awoke and stared at the window and asked his wife, "Why are you standing over there?" She sat up in bed next to him and said, "I'm right here." Next thing they knew, they were both staring at a ghostly figure in the window. As they sat up in bed, of their hearts pounding, suddenly the wife felt a hand on the back of her head. And it wasn't Bob. So they both screamed, jumped out of bed, and they described the ghost as a tall figure wearing a long white robe, and they both thought it to be a man. On another occasion, a couple who stayed in room 2 came down in the morning and said to the innkeeper, do you have a ghost? And he replied, well, actually, yes, we do, and we've come to know him as Toby. Why do you ask? And the couple then began to describe a tall figure in a long white robe standing in the window in the middle of the night. And then on another occasion, a couple from New York who were in town for a wedding stayed at the inn. And as the innkeeper put it, they were not the nicest of people.
No.
You know, they, yeah, not too impressed, I guess. Well, apparently, Toby didn't like them either. So after they checked out, the housekeepers were astonished to find pictures in the hallway had all been thrown down the stairs. When they entered the room, all the pictures had been tossed on the floor as if piled up in an angry rage.
Mm.
None of the pictures were damaged, though, in any way, and so that they believe it was the ghost of the tall man in the white robe who was just showing his disapproval with the guest, but he really didn't mean him any harm.
Okay, so who was Toby? Or who was he?
I guess they just made up that name, Toby.
Who was the ghost supposed to have been?
That we don't know. It was a ghost of the man and the tall man in the white robe. But it was never explained who he was.
It's kind of an odd costume or attire to be seen in a white robe.
It is.
Usually women are seen in like nightgowns or something, but... it almost sounds like biblical.
I was just going to say, but since the building was originally the Universalist Church,
that could probably explain
the robe. Huh?
Could be a former minister, pastor, or something like that.
Yeah, something along that line.
I wonder if they did do research and they really did know who Toby was then.
They might have.
Probably a good indication.
They might have, but I think as far as the name Toby, they just made it up something to, something
they
to
knew
call
who he
by.
Was. They knew his identity.
Yeah, probably did,
That's very interesting. See, which one shall I do next?
Don't you do that one?
Well, there's the one about the phantom fisherman or the one about the ghost ship.
Ooh.
And they're actually very good.
Do you have a fisherman on a ghost ship, maybe?
Yes.
All right, let's go with that one then.
Okay. Yeah, and it's not very long. So this actually, the home port is Gloucester, Massachusetts. The story is the Phantom Fisherman, and again, it's out of the Ghost Stories of New England. It's the captain and the crew of the Charles Haskell made a decision that would haunt them for the rest of their lives. And that's literally. During a hurricane in the winter of 1870, the ship was anchored in the fishing grounds on George's Banks. And that is, as most people know, up around Nova Scotia, Newfoundland. So the fishing area.
Yeah, one of the bigger fishing areas. I think it's like 20 miles off shore or something like that.
And it's for quite a while, it's been a popular fishing area. And they had come out of Gloucester, Massachusetts. So there was a ship or boat that was coming toward the Charles Haskell, and they were anchored. So in order not to be rammed, they cut the anchor, and they were set adrift. And by being set adrift, they wound up slamming into another fishing boat. Really sad. It was a fishing boat from actually Salem. It was a small schooner, and it sunk, and everybody on board died. The Charles Haskell managed to stay afloat, and it returned to the port of Gloucester. So months later, Captain Curtis, who was the captain of the Charles Haskell, the captain and his crew went out to George's Bank again, and they fished for nearly a week without any incident. But on the sixth night, at midnight, they discovered that they weren't alone. As the air suddenly went cold, 26 seamen wearing oilskins climbed over the boat's rails, and without a sound, the spectral crew resumed their duties on deck, baiting invisible hooks, dropping invisible lines into the ocean and staring out to sea with blank, unseeing eyes. So the crew, of course, was terrified, and they summoned the captain, and he did witness what was happening, and they all stayed up all night watching the ghostly fishermen until dawn. And when the fishermen were finished, they climbed over the rails and they disappeared into the water. And I know this sounds like a really tall tale, but wait till the ending.
Oh, it gets better.
It gets better.
All right.
Okay. So the Charles Haskell had one more night of their stint. They were going to be gone 7 nights. This happened on the 6th night. So on the 7th night, the same thing happened again. And they were all quite frightened by this. So they managed to sail the boat back to Gloucester Harbor. And as they left, the specters on the seventh night, they shot one last look at the captain. And, of course, the captain was the one responsible for cutting the tether and slamming into the boat from Salem.
Yeah.
And supposedly these ghostly figures were from the boat from Salem. So instead of vanishing into the water, the 26 ghostly figures walked across the water toward Salem Harbor.
Across the water.
They walked this time. They didn't go back into the water.
Mm, okay.
So that happened to be the end of the Charles Haskell, at least the end of its days at sea. They made it back to Gloucester Harbor, but no one would board the ship. Captain Curtis could never find a crew, and for the rest of its days, it sat in the harbor and it just fell to ruin. And that was it. No one would sail the boat again. And this actually came out of the archives at Cape Ann Historical Association. And both, you know, as everybody knows, Gloucester and Rockport are on Cape Ann. So there's an historical society there, and that's where this came from,
and
for the archives.
What year was that? For some reason, that name, the Haskell, just sounds
really
familiar.
1870.
Or maybe I'm just thinking of Eddie Haskell.
Yeah. Could be. They might be related distantly.
Could be. You know how my mind works.
But I thought that was really interesting that it was in the archives at the Cape Ann Historical Association. Walked across the water.
Yeah, not too many people can. Well, not too many live people can do it. I suppose it's a lot easier if you have a ghost.
But can you can you just imagine seeing 26 seamen boarding the ship and doing their regular duties, and then just going overboard and returning again the next night to do the same thing? That's got to be frightening.
Well, yeah, right. I think frightening would be a good word for it.
Mm. Do we have time for one more story?
Well, hey, you know, we kind of got a choice here. We can go with a quick, another haunted end story.
You got a quickie?
You had something about clocks you might want to have mentioned.
Well, okay.
We can go either way. We got about 2 minutes to do it in. So, what do you want to do?
Well, I can do the short one if you want.
All right.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
This is another personal experience that if somebody can figure this out, I'd like to know. I've had incidents with time devices. I have an alarm clock, which I have now replaced because I really think it's faulty. But what it did three times in 1 week, it went off in the middle of the night and it wasn't set. And it would go off about 2 o'clock, about 2:07, 2:11. So for 3 nights in a week, it went off. The alarm was not set. And the little arm on the clock was set for like 8:30, not 2 o'clock. So it doesn't know the difference between a.m. and p.m., but
right.
2 is not 7 or 8 or 9.
Right,
you know?
they're not even close.
That's right. And the clock wasn't set. So, okay. So I just kind of passed that off as a faulty clock. But then... then I came back one evening after I had left about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I came back about 9 p.m. The clock on the wall in the living room had come off the hook, and it was sitting in a chair beneath where it was positioned on the wall. It landed and it smashed the glass on the clock. The clock stopped because a piece of glass had stopped the arm. And it had fallen off about 2:20 in the afternoon.
But the strange part was that the hook
was still in the wall.
Yes.
And so the clock would have actually had to have lifted off the hook, right?
That's right. That's what it... Unless, you know, maybe somebody slammed the door. I have a tenant in the same building on the other side. Maybe they slammed the door and that shook the clock. That's the only thing I can think of. But again, it was about 2:20 that the clock stopped. So the last piece of evidence was Willie and I are investigating the James house, and I went upstairs. You know, we're filming, so I went upstairs to change my clothes, to change my blouse in particular, and upstairs is pretty haunted. But it was daylight, so that didn't bother me. My clock, my watch, my wristwatch stopped at that time, and it stopped working for 3 hours until we finished filming. And when we went outside to take a break at about 5, it started working again.
So that's several, rather, the
five incidents. That's kind of weird.
Five is several, yeah. But incidents of malfunctioning and clocks falling off. So
maybe some of it can be explained away, but it's not making any sense to me.
Maybe it can, but there's a lot of coincidence.
Yeah, a lot of coincidence.
And where you're dealing with a haunted building, too. Maybe mm-hmm. something is up.
Yeah.
But you know what those stories were all about? Essentially, they were about time.
They were about time.
And you know what time it is?
I do. That is a good wrap-up, Willie. You're thinking.
Well, thank you.
You must have put your thinking cap on.
Well, thank you. So, unfortunately, it is that time, and that is Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience, for another week.
You have been listening to Spirit Radio, the Paranormal Experience, with your hosts Willie Hassel and Lynn Nickerson on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
In this one of many possible worlds, all for the best, or some bizarre test. It is what it is, and whatever, time is still the infinite jest. The arrow flies when you dream. The hours tick away, the cells tick away. The watchmaker keeps to his schemes. The hours tick away, they tick away. The measure of a life is a measure of love and respect. So hard to earn, so easily.